You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot runner.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. With me in the room, and it's not the studio, which we'll get to in a second, is Allison McCann, second straight week with the crew on the pod. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
And Neil Payne, erstwhile Neil Payne, estimable Neil Payne, sports writer for 538. Hi, Neil.
Hey, how's it going, Chad?
So guys, describe for our listeners our surroundings at the moment, because it's not our usual tricked out studio with four cameras pointing at us and one of those, what's the camera on the NFL field that zigs along that line, that wire, you know?
Yeah, usually we have that aerial camera.
But now, what do we see around us, guys?
We're like coat check at Olive Garden is what this room.
Literally, there are five coats strung up around us to insulate to the room from sound. Our producer Joe has jerry-rigged this thing beautifully, but if you hear any extra sound, it's our fault.
You'll know why.
Yeah, we're the rustling coats, too many papers.
We're not adequate for our paper rustling.
I've got double insulation on mine. Gore-Tex. It's special for soundproofing. Okay, on today's show, we're going to talk about the Carolina Panthers and why they're the worst, best team of all time. Perhaps. And we will talk about Steph Curry and the Warriors, who just cannot seem to stop winning, and what that tells us about the modern NBA. And then we will also talk about Leicester City, which all show long, all three of us are going to want to pronounce Leicester City, with Mike Goodman of ESPN FC. How did a team that no one outside of Britain has heard of before make it to the top of the Premier League tables? And then we will have an extended significant digit about the turf conditions that the U.S. Women's National Team has been forced to grapple with, or run on, or not run on, actually. All right, you guys ready? Should we dive right in the Panthers?
Let's do it.
There's only one undefeated team in the NFL left, and it's not the Patriots. Instead, it's the Carolina Panthers, the same Panthers team that ESPN's Football Power Index projected to be an 8-win team on average at the beginning of the season, and now they are 12-0. So what are we to make of the Panthers now? Here's our pals over at Slate's Hang Up and Listen discussing a hot take they found about the team.
But still, this team is getting disrespected in the media, probably because of East Coast bias. Those famed hot take artists at 538.com wrote last week that the Panthers are the worst team to ever start 11-0. Now that they won again, I bet they're the worst team to ever start 12-0.
North Carolina does touch the Atlantic Ocean, I think.
East Coast bias.
Neil, if my Google search is correct, the famed hot take artist of Slate's Hang Up and Listen fame is one Neil Payne.
That's right.
Neil, defend yourself from the allegations of hot takery here on Hot Takedown.
I don't know if it necessarily needs that much defending.
Yeah.
When we looked at it, we were going just off of, we used Elo ratings, which are, certainly not a perfect gauge of team talent, but they're this power rating that, sort of tells you how good a team has been based on who they've played, how much they've won by, and certainly the Panthers have won a lot. And it also has a factor that sort of takes into account how good they have been in past seasons, and that sort of is what holds Carolina back in a lot of ways. But also, Carolina has played a phenomenally weak schedule, even compared to other teams that started the season 11-0 and now are 12-0. And so, that's kind of all my article was about, was just looking at other teams that started out as well and looking at their ELO ratings, also looking at their strength of schedule, looking at you know, how good they were in various aspects of the game, like passing and rushing on offense and defense. And when you break it down that way, the Panthers were not sort of very similar to a lot of the other teams that started 11-0 in terms of, you know, quality. And they seem to have played the weakest schedule out of any of those teams.
I will defend Neil, too, because I think this was more that he did not read to the bottom, because you go on to say that, in fact, how they're doing this is actually more impressive, you know, that they've won 11 games and without a loss, and that they've done it in such a way that they have, like, that they haven't put up these stats that you would have expected to see this season. So I think, if anything, Neil was being like, maybe they're the worst team to do this, but also how they're doing it is truly remarkable.
Yeah, and the how of it was... A big part of it was that Cam Newton, who is the quarterback for the Panthers, has been pretty good, but not like the best in the league. And a lot of times when we see these teams that are like historically awesome, like that show up as the best, you know, to go 11-0, and in some cases they went undefeated for the whole season, in the case of the 2007 Patriots, you see a performance by a quarterback that is just off the charts. And it was a compliment, I think, when I compared this Panthers team to another team that didn't get outstanding quarterback and was relying on its defense and was relying on rushing the football in the 1985 Bears. Those 85 Bears are considered one of the best teams ever in the history of the NFL, and their quarterback, Jim McMahon, was not necessarily, you know, the best in the league, but he was good, and he was good enough to make them great when combined with the rushing of Walter Payton and this defense that's considered one of the best in the history of the NFL. So
maybe it's not East Coast bias as much as that the NFL is biased towards quarterbacks in a way, right? Like, we're used to these really dominant teams having great quarterback, as you just said, and the reason why they're the weakest, quote unquote, of the 11-0 teams is because the NFL is rigged, that it's rigged so that you can only be a, quote, great team or when you have a great quarterback. But the Panthers are sort of cutting against that, if I'm understanding correctly.
Right, yeah. As part of our theme song says, they're shattering the mold, just like Tebow. They they have a passing offense that's like decent, but it's not the best in the league by any stretch of the imagination. And yeah, whenever we talk about teams, what they need to be great, what they need to win the Super Bowl, we always say, oh, the first thing that they need is one of the best quarterbacks in the league. And then, you know, if you don't have that, there's a sense that you can't be great. And if you do have that, then there's the expectation that you should be great. And they're sort of flipping that on its head. And they're showing that you can have like a really good quarterback, but not, you know, one of the top five in football and still be a juggernaut.
You did say, Neil, that if there is, like, I love that you wrote this, that the stats have a blind spot, it could be Newton's ability to throw the ball deep. You said that he ranks 7th in QBR on passes that travel 20 or more yards through the air. So, you know, as a casual NFL fan, I was like, oh, is throwing the ball deep not like a very, I guess, whatever, fancy stat for quarterbacks? This is kind of like, you know, this is a thing that he does well, but why did you call it a stats blind spot?
Well, I think it is something that sort of helps the rest of your team, like just even the threat of it. Like, deep passes don't make up a huge number of the passes that you throw in any game. But if the defense always has it in the back of their mind that, oh, you know,
your
crap,
secret this, weapon.
Yeah, he could go deep on us at any point. All you need to do is just do it a couple times per game just to prove that you can do it. And then it opens up the rushing game. And maybe that's a part of why you see Carolina, who's really effective at running the ball. And it also bears mentioning that Cam Newton is one of the best rushing quarterbacks in football. And so he sort of helps his case, even though he doesn't help the statistics for passing. He is feeding into the Panthers' running game statistically.
That's so funny. It's like, I could pass if I wanted to, right. But it's like some weird reverse psych.
Yeah, it's some game theory stuff, and that is sort of where the stats never quite... Well, is there a stat that sort of gets at that game? Could there be a stat where you look at like the like defensive formations normally versus the ones played against the Panthers or something? Maybe this is too esoteric for the listeners out there, but it seems like to me at some point maybe that's something that we need to get to in analytics, is the ability to sort of pick up on the what threats do within a game, the threat of action X instead of just the action actually happening.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept, and something along those lines is almost like trying to find what's called like the Nash equilibrium, where theoretically, if a team had a really efficient mix of its passes and its runs, and you could even break down like the types of passes and the types of runs, they would all be equally efficient. They, you know, you would reach a point where, assuming the defense has also kind of responded in the way that it's capable of responding, that you would be indifferent as to whether you run or pass. And in the NFL, passes still are more efficient. They pick up more, not just yards, but expected points and win probability points than rushes. So that sort of suggests that teams as a whole are not passing enough relative to runs. But then at the same time, the Panthers, because they are a team that is more efficient running than passing relative to the league average in each category, they might be a team that has actually come closer to finding that Nash equilibrium than the average team. And maybe that's a secret, you know, an underrated, under the radar secret to their success. Who knows?
That's also like mind boggling to just be like, the perfect composition of this team is that like nobody, like we're good at everything, but like there is no strong aspect of our game, or like that everything would just be an equilibrium. But that's so, I don't know, counter to.
Yeah, and also, it's not like Ron Rivera is sitting there like trying to run a game theory equation and figure out, like, a lot of this stuff is developed by feel, I think, in the NFL still, or in sports in general, and we'll talk about that with Steph Curry a little bit later. And, you know, the thinking behind this might be complex from the outside looking in, but when you're on the sidelines, I'm not sure. Maybe when you're doing a game plan or something, you're thinking, oh, we should do 25 passes versus 15 runs in the first half or something. But like, I'm not sure it's because you know your efficiency rate is X percent versus Y percent on those two sets of plays.
Yeah, and a lot of coaches strive for balance. They really want to keep things. They even have an offensive quality control coach. One of his jobs, and that's an actual job description, is to sit in the booth with the offensive coordinator and basically just figure out, like, are we out of whack in terms of the number of passes versus the number of runs? And, you know, they will target, like, not necessarily always to be perfectly equal with each, but I think they really would like to be, all else considered equal, they would want the number of runs and passes to be pretty close to each other. But there's an argument to be made, if you're like a super efficient passing team and like not that efficient of a rushing team, that it shouldn't be equal. Like if either one is sort of fundamentally different in efficiency level than the other, then you would want to try to find that sweet spot where you could maximize the efficiency of the rushing by doing it less and passing more. And even if the passing, passing more causes your passing efficiency to go down, you can find that sweet spot where they mix together and give you the best overall offense. But it changes constantly, so it's kind of this constant cat and mouse game with the defense and with your own players and situations. So it's just endlessly complex,
and it's difficult to make those changes based on short-term information versus long-term information versus short-term information. Where if someone stuffs you for runs in a row, all of a sudden you might think, "Oh, I better pass now." Okay, Neil, I feel like you've successfully defended your quote hot take end quote.
Slate wants to come over.
Hang up.
We'll
listen.
Be here.
Let's go.
In the coat room.
You know where to find us.
We have to be in the coat room.
Please bring a couple bucks for some
no
tips.
No one can hear your screams from the coat room.
All right. The Golden State Warriors are 22-0 as of this taping. Steph Curry is on pace to double all sorts of three-point records, and the Warriors starters are not even playing the fourth quarter most of the time. Guys, is it possible that the Warriors are so hot that no take about them can be too hot? Because they're just so good. It's amazing to watch. We did our best, though, to find a hot take. Here's ESPN senior NBA writer Mark Stein.
They got the best chemistry in the league. They've got so much offensive versatility. And now it's a confidence thing. Just winning the championship and the way they've started this season. They have a swagger that we really haven't seen, dare I say it, since the 96 Bulls.
Chemistry, confidence, swagger.
Swagger.
I also like that music that was playing in the background during the hot take.
We can get a new theme for us when we're tired of ours. So those three words are like three words that are sure to set off alarm bells within the hot take coat check room. And it seems like so much more than chemistry, swagger, and I've already forgotten the third because it's such a meaningless, nothing, empty word. But, you know, they're just better, right, guys? They're just better than all the other teams. It's about talent. It's not about some ineffable quality that they have emotionally.
It's about Steph Curry, right?
You think it's all Curry?
After reading Steph Curry is the Revolution, Ben Morris's wonderful piece last week, I am convinced that he is better than we can ever imagine. That, like, it's mind-boggling. Like, he does bad things good, and he should be taking shots from everyone on his team. Like, we should run games where he's the only one that plays, like, 1 versus 5, and, like, see what happens. Like, these are the only ways we'll be able to know how good Steph Curry is.
And for listeners, real quick, this is a piece that Benjamin Morris wrote on 538 called Steph Curry is the Revolution, that basically said that the three-pointer is not the revolution in the NBA. Steph Curry is the revolution. And that what Steph Curry is doing sort of, like, bends basketball math into a whole new discipline, basically. Like, it's like taking the step up from algebra to calculus or something like that. Neil, are you sold on that? That Steph Curry is actually the Warriors, and the Warriors are Steph Curry?
I mean, I loved Ben's piece. I thought that, you know, it shed a lot of light on what Curry does and the fact that, you know, he is the best player in the NBA, which in some ways is sort of self-explanatory. But he also talked about, like, why. And I love the fact that, like, for most players, there's this efficiency curve where the more, and it goes kind of to what we were saying in the first segment in football, where, like, the more you use something, in this case, the Warriors are using Curry on offense, the less efficient it becomes. It seems like it has to. It's just one of those, like, fundamental truths of life that there must be diminishing returns. But for Curry, there don't seem to be diminishing returns. And it's one of those things where, no matter how close the defense gets to him, Ben had a chart with that, he still makes at, you know, an incredibly high rate. And, you know, no matter how late it is in the shot clock, so he's being forced to take bad shots, he's still, there are only, you know, he is capable of making shots at a higher rate than any of his teammates and really anyone else in the league.
Curry shoots three-pointers, according to Morris, about as well with a defender 2 to 4 feet away when the shot goes off as an average NBA shooter does with the nearest defender 12 feet away. That's just incredible. And just, as we've been saying, defies everything. So, okay, so I understand that Curry should be getting more and more shots. At some point, defenses would adjust and, like, triple-team the guy. And that's where I think, while it is all Curry, it's also about the other guys being able to absorb whatever passes come their way and make good, efficient use of it too, right? Like, this isn't – we've seen other teams with just one really great player, and we've seen many of them around the league actually. But the way that the team is playing as a team and that the ability of five people on the court to finish the ball is also part of it.
Yeah, and one of the players that I think might not get as much credit as he deserves if we're just focusing on Curry the whole time is Draymond Green. Green's ability to sort of play – many different positions. He acts as a facilitator, even though he plays center sometimes, even though he's undersized for it, but he can still defend it, and he still has a really high rebound rate. He is, in almost as many ways as Curry is unique or game-breaking. Maybe it's a stretch to say almost as many, but in a lot of similar ways, he is a unique player and allows them to play the style that Curry flourishes in. So I don't want to run the risk of underrating him. Or, you know, there are many other great players on the team. And what's really interesting and fun about the Warriors is they were a team that – sort of, if you weren't paying that much attention, you would have thought, oh, they came out of nowhere last year and became this juggernaut. And then maybe that would have led to the temptation to say, well, this year they'll come back to earth. Defenses will adjust. And
Carmelo had Curry coming back to earth. I think they had him regressing like by 5 wins above replacement or something like that to the mean. And now all of a sudden he's on pace for 5 higher or something like that. I forget the exact.
And we'll save that for the Carmelo hot takedown that we do at some point, the Carmelo audit, self-audit that
Carmelo,
we do.
Carmelo, we should say, is a player rating system that 538 developed.
Yeah, a player projection system. But, yeah, you know, they were a team that, if you look at the advanced stats, they saw them being good. They didn't see them being this good. You know, you don't want to take too much credit because the stats didn't even see the Warriors becoming quite as good as they are, like potentially breaking the Bulls' record for wins in a single season. But at the same time, they have a lot of really, you know, good young players who could only get better in the way that NBA players age. And so if you sort of mash them all together and tried to come up with a projection off of that, it projected that they would be the best team in basketball last year and that they would continue to be the best team this year. So in some ways, it's not just Steph Curry going off the reservation and becoming, you know, the second coming of LeBron mixed with Michael Jordan mixed with Wilt Chamberlain. They have a really good roster, and he didn't need to do that. He's playing great. He's arguably having, you know, the best start to a season anyone ever had. But then there are other building blocks that you need to get from having Curry to also being arguably the best team through the start of the season.
But if, I don't know, I guess I find the, like, that the Warriors are now the 95-96 Bulls, which to me translates to, like, the 95-96 Bulls is like Jordan's heyday, right? Like, yeah. We talk about the Warriors like the Bulls, and because we're talking about Steph, like, we're talking about Jordan, right? These people that had just, like, an insane season. And so, I don't know. I just, every time we talk about the Warriors, all I want to do is talk about Steph. I think in Ben's piece, to me, what was fascinating is him trying to, like, quantify this idea of burden and, like, how much Steph is really doing for this team. And that he, you know, goes on to say that he's taken more and more responsibility with shooting, and he just continues to get better. It's not like as he gets double teamed or he takes, I guess, worse shots, he continues to improve. And that's what Ben was trying to understand, like how much is a good non-Curry shot versus like a bad Curry shot. And he is arguing that the math is suggesting that we should take more bad Curry shots than non-Curry. So I do appreciate Neil's take that it is a combined
Warriors team effort.
Well, but what we're saying is that the Warriors haven't even approached the equilibrium. Like,
yeah.
if NFL offenses are not passing as much as they should, I mean, the Warriors seem like there's a huge gap between what Curry could be doing and what he's actually doing.
Right, that's what I want to see. I want to see go until we.
But you
see
might have to wait till the playoffs for that to happen,
yes,
right?
We won't
see the 80-point game that we all want. So we should mention what comes next for the Warriors in the sense that will they ever lose? One of my favorite recurring Twitter gags right now is this guy Dan Amira, who's I think a writer for The Daily Show. He tweets, will the Warriors ever lose? He tweeted, will the Warriors ever lose after, you know, they won 5 in a row to start the season? And he's been doing it after every time they win. And so there's this great Twitter chain of just him talking to himself. Anyway, so the Kyle Wagner, 538's new sports editor, wrote a piece based on some NBA projections that 538 did about how many, if you simulate the rest of the season 10,000 times, how many of those simulations, based on what we know about the Warriors and their schedule and the rest of the league, would they win 72 games and tie the Bulls' record? And guys, they are more likely than not to tie the record at this point, which is just crazy. So 72 wins, the chance of at least that many wins of 72 wins thus far is 54%. A quarter of the time they get 75 wins. That's crazy. I mean, and partly it's because of how few losses they've had already, so there's not much time for them to lose 10 more as there would be for other teams. And so is this just going to be the story of the year in the NBA? Can anything top this? It seems like this is it, right?
I think so. I mean, it's all anyone really wants to talk about. Like, if you go to any NBA blog or the front page of the NBA at ESPN.com, it's just Warriors mania. There's like 3 Warrior stories to every one for any other team.
And anecdotally, the traffic for those stories, if I can put my editor of a website on, are higher than if you wrote about even Anthony Davis, you know, and the Pelicans not being
LeBron.
Good or something like that.
Who's LeBron?
Right. Yeah, who's LeBron?
Who's
Please.
This guy?
It's true. I don't think we've mentioned LeBron all season long on Hot Takedown. Maybe that's a telling detail. Okay, when the Warriors are 44-0, we'll be right back here running with 10,000 more simulations, and we'll let you know what they say. One third of the way through the English Premier League season, Leicester City somehow sits in first place atop the tables with more than double the point total of last year's champion Chelsea. What is going on across the Atlantic? We sent up a flare for Mike Goodman, ESPN FC writer, to help us out and come here and explain what's happening. Mike Goodman, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
Hey guys, how are you?
Good. Mike, let's start with the basics. Am I pronouncing Leicester City correctly?
You are the Leicester City Fighting Leicesters.
Okay, so
whenever we do soccer, it's like so sad. We're just like, we gotta up our soccer cred.
You're right. We gotta do some off-season studying.
We got a lot of heat for our MLS shame on the supporters' shield last week, and so We want to say that we got everyone's responses. We weren't trying to diminish the supporters' shield. We were more, I think, making fun of the kind of lame name.
But it was the fans who were the supporters. That's what I feel bad about, that we were making fun of the fans in a way.
Yeah, that's what it seemed like.
I'm
but
sorry,
we weren't.
MLS fans.
Anyway.
Okay, back to England. So, Mike, some soccer diehards really think that this Leicester team can last. Let's get to the hot take first. Here's legendary former Manchester United manager Sir Alex Ferguson telling us maybe, just maybe, little Leicester City can go all the way this year.
This is a team with fantastic vitality, speed, energy. At the moment, Leicester are the best team in the league, without doubt. But the question is, how long will it last? Mm-hmm. Have they the resources to continue throughout the season? The way they are playing at the moment, you could win the league.
Mike, have they the underlying data fundamentals to stick around for the rest of the season?
So they have a pretty solid profile. You don't look at them and say, you know, that they're winning on the back of, you know, wonder goals flying in from out of nowhere or a keeper standing on his head. They've got, you know, they're good sort of value for their performances. Now, there's two big caveats. The first is that they've had probably the easiest schedule in the Premier League today, and things are about to get much more difficult. They have Chelsea coming up, which who knows what that means at this point. But then they have Everton, Liverpool, and Manchester City after that. So
all of which are kind of having, like, I mean, besides Man City, everybody else is having sort of a meh season, right? Like, everyone keeps talking about this. Their schedule is about to get harder, which I do agree with, but comparatively, these teams have been very meh.
It's a little bit of a weird year, right? Like, you've had a lot of teams that have schedules which should, in theory, have gotten easier, and they haven't taken advantage of it, and then have sort of proved resilient in harder stretches. And that sort of plays into the second thing that's going on a little bit here with Leicester City, which is that they're leading the Premier League, but they don't exactly have a hugely impressive points total to be sitting on top of the league. I think at this point in the season, it's the lowest point total since sometime in the mid. I guess Chelsea a few years ago were close, and then it was sometime in the mid-90s before that. So oftentimes you'd be looking at this Leicester team and they'd be sitting in, say, second or third place, and you'd be wondering if they could, you know, if they could make that stick.
It's kind of like we talked about, you weren't on earlier, obviously, Mike, but we talked about the Panthers in our first segment and how they are the worst, best team in the NFL, and had a similar conclusion that, like, they're winning their games by fewer points. And you're saying the same thing, that they're, you know, at the point that they are in the season, they should have more points in the table, and they don't. So what we expect from the top is, like, apparently in all of our sports, just dropping.
Yeah, exactly. Parity reigns everywhere, apparently.
Yeah, it sounds like it almost says more about the rest of the EPL, or as much about the rest of the EPL as it does about Leicester?
Well, it does, but it also, I mean, so you don't want to discount the fact that Leicester is the team that has sort of risen up in this season, right? I mean, they've played very, very well so far. The question kind of continues a tricky one, because their fundamentals are good, but there's sort of a bunch of teams over the past several years where they're good, they're surprising, they're in the top four around Christmas and New Year's, and it's just such a long slog. Smaller teams tend to have shallower squads, so they don't have enough players to, you know, as many players to ride out injuries and mishaps, and things start to get tough. Plus the fact that, you know, you're about to hit the second time through the league, and Leicester have sort of benefited, I think, from having a new manager, from playing slightly differently than expected, and you're not sure if you're going to see that function later in the season.
Interesting, because one of the things I was going to ask is, do we have a sense of sort of what point in the season do things sort of have to be taken more seriously? Like, we're about 40% through the schedule, right? And this Leicester team was, what, 2000 to 1 to win the EPL, I think, before the season? And so.
And I totally picked them to get relegated.
You weren't the only one. Is there a sense of, like, at what point in the season do we adjust that preseason expectation? And the same goes for Chelsea, I think, in the opposite direction. Or do we need to give it more time? Is 15 games enough of a sample? Or where on those two poles of, like, it
okay, so we're definitely there if we're talking about adjusting our preseason tires. This is more than enough games to look at it and confidently say, okay, yeah, we were wrong. We missed. Soccer is a sport, when you're talking predictions and when you're talking numbers, generally relies on previous season performances more heavily than other sports. Basically, I mean, for a lot of reasons, but it has to do with it's very hard to isolate a lot of different specific player performances in such a low event sport, whatever. So you start from the prior season. But by the time we're 15 games in, yeah, it's enough to look at, especially when you have a team like Leicester that's performed well, as opposed to the other sort of early season darlings were West Ham, who are now, I think, have dropped to seventh. And they, it was pretty clear, were riding their results more than they were riding their performances. And so you say, okay, well, we still expect them to fall off. But, I mean, Leicester, they're certainly good, and now the question is exactly how much are we adjusting our priors? You know, how much have they moved the needle already?
It's not just the team, though. It's also the players within the team. I mean, Jamie Vardy and Riyad Mahrez, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but they've been great, and so it's not just about whether the team can continue, it's about whether or not the players can continue within the team. Is it harder to know whether the fundamentals of a player have radically changed than it is the fundamentals of a team?
Yeah, so especially the Mahrez case, he came out of close to nowhere. He was bought from a small team in France, and he was pretty good down the stretch last year, but, you know, this is an unexpected degree of performance. Vardy, he's not young. The fact that he's, you know, he's sort of been painted as this story of, you know, buried in the lower divisions of England, and suddenly he has this, you know, miraculous rise. And that's not really true. Everybody knew he had talent. Even before sort of last season when he was, you know, caught on film saying racist things, he had behavioral issues in the lower divisions. Both legal ones and on-the-field ones. Leicester bought him for $1 million from, from a club outside of the top four divisions, which is an unheard-of amount of money.
Really high, considering how low he was.
Exactly. So there was always this understanding that Vardy had talent. There were just, you know, justified considerable concerns about his makeup.
Okay, Mike, and I'm curious if you agree with Stuart James, who over in The Guardian said that according to Opta, Vardy and Mahrez are the second and sixth best players in Europe right now. That would actually put Mahrez above Messi and Suarez. So do you agree with him?
Well, I mean, I think it obviously depends on what sort of criteria you're using to rank teams, rank players. But, I mean, if you're just looking at their output this year and sort of their contributions to goals and assists, I mean, they've been as important to their team as anybody. I mean, there's no way around it. I think if you're talking about how good are players, you don't want to put 15 games up against, you know, almost a decade's worth of work. But, yeah, for sure, for this season, for Leicester, they are as important to their team as anybody is to their team.
So, one more thing. Speaking of Messi and Suarez, I think what I like most about this Leicester team is that they're terrible at possessing the ball, which goes against everything that I thought I knew about soccer.
Well, that's partly because you came up in the Barcelona era,
yeah,
right?
Only Sunderland and West Brom have had less possession than them this season, and they have the poorest pass completion rate in the league. And here they are doing well, and I'm just like, this is... You know, they're like this scrappy, they're playing it to the wing and they're crossing and they're getting goals. And it's like, I don't know, putting me back to my like rec soccer days.
So, but does that not suggest, isn't that not as high probability of scoring a goal because there's more interceptions in the air that could happen or there's 50-50
so
goals?
There are sort of like countervailing tendencies here, right? Attacking quickly tends to mean that you're going to get a better quality shot because you're getting into, if you're getting into good position, because you're getting into positions before the defense is settled. Basically, you don't want to be in the middle, right? You don't want to be taking enough time that the defense can sort of settle in without taking so much time that you then carve the defense apart. If you can get down the field and get into good shooting positions before the defense gets settled, you're going to be taking good shots. So the question is, for the rest of the year for Leicester, are teams going to sort of adjust, and are they just going to really sit back, and are Leicester going to be able to get the sort of scoring opportunities they've gotten so far?
Okay, Mike, we've had you on to talk about how disappointing and surprisingly disappointing Chelsea has been. We've had you on to talk about how surprisingly good Leicester has been and how surprisingly okay our pronunciation of Leicester City has been. I think we only made one or two mistakes.
Yeah, I think that was me.
Maybe next time we'll have you on to talk about something, you know, status quo, something milquetoast.
That's something in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although we know that's not a high probability podcast appearance based on what you just told us. Got to be on either end. All right, Mike Goodman, ESPN FC writer. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks, Lucas.
Okay, now to bring the show home, as always, our significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. Alice McCann, already in the room. Allison, what have you brought us for Sig Dig this week?
As always, it's never a digit, significant digit. So this week is 8 out of 10.
80%. That's a digit.
But I like 8 out of 10 better because that is the number of games that the U.S. Women's National Team are playing on turf in their victory tour after winning the World Cup. After being world champions, they come back to the U.S. and play 8 games on turf.
Well, they won on turf, Allison. So they must have felt really comfortable on the Canadian turf.
That must be it. This sort of came to a head this past weekend. They were playing in Hawaii in a friendly match against Trinidad and Tobago, and they didn't play. They refused to play because of the field conditions, which the turf was pulling up, and there were metal pellets in it and all kinds of things. So, it was. I think pretty remarkable for me to see a team just say we're not going to play this game. And there's been a lot of controversy surrounding the way that U.S. Soccer sort of treats the men's and women's national teams and how they're supposed to play at the Alamo Dome on Thursday when the U.S. men played Mexico there in April. They put grass over that turf and they don't plan to do that this week. And sort of this double standard that we are seeing again.
And it's the same authority that governs both of them, right?
Correct, yeah. This is
so it's just a total negligence and blatant ignoring of the desires of the team.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, there's an argument that putting grass over turf is also not a great solution. So this is not saying that the men are being treated wonderfully either. Both situations are not great, but there is a discrepancy in the way they are playing. And just finding grass in America, a stadium, there's MLS stadiums all over the place, and they are just choosing to put them in football stadiums and things with turf. And, you know, there are much bigger factors at play here with money and size of venue and things. But these women are just saying this is dangerous and we are not going to play on it. So
now, is some of this because they're playing in football stadiums and, you know, they're the defending World Cup champs, people want to see them? Is it almost like they are a victim of that success? It doesn't excuse the fact that they're not putting the grass down over the turf when they could, but is it just the fact that they're playing at turf venues, like base level turf venues? Is it because they need more seats or something? Is there anything to that, or is this just, you know?
I'm sure. I think it's a combination of all the things, but, you know, and what we see on the side of it is that they're coming out with the short end of the stick or whatever with the deal. But I think they were strategic in trying to put, I mean, this was the first time the team had ever played in Hawaii. So I think that was, you know, really exciting for them to build this market of, you know, Hawaiian fans and people that don't get to see this team play. So I think there were all these things in place, and the U.S. soccer had said, well, they play, you know, the Pro Bowl there and they play things there. We just assumed it was fine and stuff. But they had not even sent anyone to check the field like they, I guess, do for the men's team. So there were all these sort of questions of treatment that I think were really interesting to me, beyond just the idea of turf versus grass. You know, it's just like not caring as much about the conditions for this team.
And I guess just not listening, not, you know, if they had just asked, they would just, both teams, no one likes to play soccer on turf, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So what I'm still sort of confused about this story for is, like, they're in Hawaii because they're on this victory tour, but they who chose to go to Hawaii? You know what I mean?
U.S. Soccer.
Okay, and so they so U.S. Soccer could have chosen that they were only going to go to Hawaii if they had a grass field.
Correct.
Okay.
U.S. Soccer chose all the venues, all the victory tour locations, and spots for where they, you know, are going to go and serve the most fans at the most convenient time. So I'm sure doing this victory tour during the NFL season and other things and the MLS season puts a lot of constraints. I'm not saying that U.S. Soccer is just doing nothing, but I don't think they are doing enough.
And U.S. Soccer controls both the men's and the women's team's destinies and things like this.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, it's just speaks to this whole like strange governing body of soccer globally, which we've talked about a lot, and the U.S. having the same sort of like governing body of soccer that sort of owns these men's and women's teams in a way that I think a lot of our national team sports don't work that way.
Let me make one more point, which is that this is a friendly, right, that against Trinidad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that they didn't play, I think, shows you how frustrated they must have been to have played the World Cup on turf, right? I mean, this field sounded particularly bad with rocks thrown about and the turf was coming up at the seams. But we wouldn't, I don't think, have seen them boycott a match if there were stakes, something at stake in the match, right? And so it shows you the kind of things that athletes put up with, conditions that athletes put up with sometimes for the sake of competition and for the sake of the larger pursuit to a trophy or to glory. And it's one of those, I think, telling moments where you can see, all things being equal, what some people's preference would be to not endanger themselves and their careers. But sometimes they put that aside.
And who knows how many times, you know, in the World Cup or one of these competitions that actually, quote unquote, matters, they had to put up with adverse and perhaps dangerous conditions, but because the stakes were high enough. So in this case, the stakes were just low enough for them to be able to say, hey, we don't want to do this. This isn't safe. But, you know, there's probably for every time that that's true, many, many occasions where they had to soldier on through it and risk injury.
Yeah. For me, it was really frustrating looking into this just a little bit yesterday for my piece, was trying to find good literature on this turf versus grass battle. And like, it's been, you know, the scientific literature on it has been very small. And, you know, in Norway and Sweden, you know, the studies will be like five men's team in Sweden during, you know, during the winter. And it's like, you can't tell me that that's the same conditions in turf in the summer in Vancouver for women with different knee structure.
But that's the research that FIFA trots out, right?
Yeah, and so I don't know if there are these big differences between turf and grass, but I don't like the idea of just saying, like, there's been no study yet, so everything is the same now. I think that hopefully we'll be, you know, seeing some smarter studies and better ways of measuring this and differences between men and women and differences in conditions. If it's new, you know, the FIFA studies are also on this like FIFA certified turf, which is not the turf that's in Hawaii, you know, at the Aloha Stadium. So
it's
anyway,
Pro Bowl certified.
Yeah.
Okay. So people can read your piece about this on 538.com. It's a great read that will only stoke people's ire, I think, even further. Allison, thanks for Sig Dig as always.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming on Hot Takedown as always. Neil, thanks to you too.
Aw, thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast baron is Jody Abergin. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. And of course, you can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're on iTunes as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.